Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, July 8th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, Doreen Nickel speaks to author and professor Dennis Raphael about the idea of social murder and how it applies to Doug Ford's government. The expression social murder was first introduced by Friedrich Engels, a German political economist in the 1840s. In his book, The Condition of the Working Class in England, Engels describes the misery and class division he witnessed in day-to-day English life. His conclusion? Proletarian revolution was necessary. In 2007, the term was reintroduced by Canadian economists Robert Chenomes and Ian Hudson. Their book, called Social Murder and the Other Shortcomings of Conservative Economics, outlined how the influence and size of corporate power is shaping the world in a negative way. Corporations are able to wreak social and environmental havoc with few serious consequences. Fast forward again to today, and the term has gained popularity once again when referring to the recently re-elected Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, and his government. Specifically, the cuts the Ford government has made to Ontario's public health care system. Dennis Raphael explains why this term is being used and what exactly it means in today's interview. Raphael is a professor of health policy at York University and is the author of over 150 publications that speak to topics in public policy, poverty, and social determinants of health. A longtime community activist, Raphael has authored charters and community research manuals and is also a member of various working groups and advisory committees. Doreen Nickel is a social activist, freelance writer, and frequent contributor to Rabble.ca. In 2016, she won the Hamilton Independent Media Award for Social Justice and Human Rights. Here are Nickel and Raphael in conversation. Take a listen.
So, welcome to Rabble, Dennis.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. In a recent op-ed, you stated, "The austerity policies of the Ford government, by worsening the living conditions of Ontario's most vulnerable, would lead to social murder." Could you explain to Rabble listeners what social murder is?
Well, let me just give a little bit of background. Since 1996, there's been an extensive literature brought on primarily by Richard Wilkinson's book about unhealthy societies, the afflictions of inequality. And it spawned a concern with what we call the social determinants of health. And these are living and working conditions. And there's a list of them that could be income, working conditions, job security, food security, housing. And these living and working conditions are the primary determinants of health. Now, what does that mean? Well, basically what it means is that some people stay healthy and live long, and other people get sick and they die. And it turns out that just about every disease you can think of, heart disease, diabetes, respiratory disease, arthritis, all of these are strongly related to the living and working conditions that people experience. In academia, we tend to use terms like morbidity for sickness and mortality for premature death. But turns out, and it actually, I think, began in about 2003, that Canadian economist Robert Chenomes wrote a book about conservative politics, and he actually brought back this term social murder. And the term social murder was used by Friedrich Engels in 1845 in his book, The Condition of the Working Class. And basically what he said was that the living and working conditions that people were experiencing during the Industrial Revolution were sickening and killing them. And he said that this is a result of excessive profit making by what he called the bourgeoisie with the complicity of the state. And he said that since these people knew that these living and working conditions were going to sicken and die, and since they knew about it, didn't do anything about it, he accused them of committing social murder. And social murder was basically putting people in conditions by which they could not survive and would die. Since then, and we've been able to document this, there's been a greater willingness, I believe, in the face of growing social and health inequalities and the failure of people like me to get any traction on this, to begin to use more aggressive terms. So instead of me saying that the austerity policies are going to lead to greater morbidity and premature mortality, in that particular column and in writing we've been doing, we've been calling a spade, that this is social murder. Because we know when you keep people on social assistance levels like this, they cannot survive, they cannot eat, they cannot stay healthy. And all the evidence shows that these people, especially the bottom 15 to 20% of the population, are going to come down in rates that are 2, 3, 4 times higher than wealthy people of life-threatening diabetes, life-threatening cardiovascular disease, life-threatening respiratory disease. And when you look at the statistics, this is all documented. Even Statistics Canada does not attribute this to unhealthy lifestyles. But of course, if you go to the Canadian Diabetes Association website, or you go to heart and stroke, that's the only thing they talk about. So the idea of social murder is that people are not dying because they're smoking or drinking or exercising. They're dying because they're being forced into living in working conditions that we know cannot sustain health. And yet the powers that be go along with it. And to show you how insidious this all becomes, imagine that people who use food banks are the ones that are already sick, but are also more likely to succumb to this. And what we discovered over the last few years, that as many of us were talking about how big corporations pay minimum wages, don't provide benefits, for example, Walmart, and we've been talking about how Walmart contributes to the problem we're concerned with, we've now found that companies like Walmart have come to control food bank associations. So, for example, Food Banks Canada, which is one of the biggest organizations across Canada, the chair of the board of directors is a vice president of Walmart. So we carefully analyzed all of their statements, and guess what? Food Banks Canada doesn't call for greater unionization. Food Banks Canada does not call for taxing wealthy corporations in order to improve social assistance. So to come back to your question, we have social murder being committed, and the same people that one could suggest are responsible for this have come to dominate public policy, dominate charitable institutions, and they basically taking the discourse of inequity, inequality in power and influence right off the table. So the idea is that if I write a column that Doug Ford's policies are going to make life difficult for people, nobody cares about that. If I come out and say, oh, it's going to have premature mortality, that doesn't mean anything to people. But the idea was that if we start using terms like social murder, the idea is not only to make it explicit what we're talking about, but to link it back to the politics of critique of the economic and political system. We've just finished a paper where we show that what Engels identified in 1845 in Manchester are the same processes that are happening in Canada in 2022.
Okay, let's take a look at the policies then. So the health of all Ontarians, but particularly marginalized and vulnerable populations, was impacted by many decisions that the Ford government made. How does that amount to social murder?
Anytime that you reduce the resources that are available to the bottom 20 to 30% of people, anytime they have less resources, less control over their lives, less ability to influence their living and working conditions, you're creating the processes that lead to greater sickness and death. So if you increase the minimum wage to $18, you're giving people more control over their lives. You're giving them the ability to manage their stress, to perhaps get the prescription drugs that they need. So income is the primary determinant of health. So anything you do that reduces the amount of income that people have makes the likelihood of sickness and death more likely. And as someone once said, if poverty was profitable, we'd end it tomorrow. So clearly there are vested interests, of which Doug Ford probably represents the petty bourgeoisie, while it's been pointed out that the liberals are much more aligned with the big business, while Doug Ford is probably more likely to be aligned with, you know, smaller business. But in the end, they all benefit from it.
I like the image that you created. It's a really effective way to explain income inequality. You say income inequality means that 40,000 Canadians die each year. That's because they're not as healthy as the wealthiest 20%. That's the equivalent of one passenger jet plane falling out of the sky every day for a year. If we know that poverty creates bad health outcomes, why not create policy that ends that poverty?
Because obviously there are competing interests. And our analysis, political science talk about different forms of the welfare state, but they also are, they believe in solidarity. And it turns out historically, they've been very much influenced by the Catholic Church. And they themselves are also anti-liberal in their own way. And what I mean by anti-liberal, the liberal welfare state is England. It's industrial revolution, its emphasis on the marketplace, its emphasis on capitalist enterprise. And their primary inspiration is to get government out of the way. And it turns out that's UK, Canada, United States, New Zealand, Australia, and Ireland. And they have structures that are set up that the dominant institution is the marketplace, not the state. And the way that plays out in a whole range of policies, and William Carroll's stuff on fossil fuel and is great, is that the corporate sector dominates public policy. And governments are not going to do anything that is going to go against their interests. And what are their interests? You see it. Low wages, lack of unionization, weak welfare state, low taxes on the wealthy and corporations. And that's a liberal welfare state. The history of it has been consistent with some anomalies. Medicare is an anomaly. And other things that are public are only public because they don't operate if they're private. You can't have an entire school system that's private. So there's a whole, why do we have public transportation? Because it's not profitable. Why do we have public schools? Because you can't make money on them. We know all of this stuff. We have examples. It's not just Scandinavia, it's continental Europe. We know that if we change the tax structure and we transfer $15,000 a year from the wealthiest to the poorest, we turn their lives around on a dime. And that's what most countries do. Their tax structures are set up that people at the bottom get a good social minimum. Also, in many countries, if you're working, you're not poor, which is quite a contrast to us. So the analysis is one that we have a long history of corporate dominance. Corporate dominance has been increasing with the resurgence of neoliberalism. And neoliberalism is just a reinforcement of what's always been here. We've always been a liberal welfare state. And some of the things that continue to support that is not only corporate dominance, but the first past the post system is also only limited to liberal welfare states. So in the Scandinavian and continental countries, if there's a pro-business party, and even their pro-business parties are not as pro-business as ours are, they can't get a majority. So every government has to listen to the left in some form. In Sweden, you have the Social Democratic Party and the Left Party. And if any of your listeners watch the TV series on Netflix, Borgen, B-O-R-G-E-N, you can see how proportional representation plays out in Danish democracy, that the woman who's the heroine is a centrist. But because she can't get 50% of the votes, she has to talk to the left. She has to talk to the Greens. She has to talk to the left, So you have a completely different dynamic. And that's why you see even so-called progressive newspapers like the Toronto Star oppose proportional representation. And everybody says, oh, we'll end up like Israel, we'll end up like Ireland. That's not what they're afraid of. They're afraid that you're going to remove the ability of the Liberal or Conservative Party to dominate public policy. And if you look at the history of Canada, we only got Medicare when there was a minority government with the NDP holding the control. And we only got public pensions when there was a minority government. The way we are now, we may have minority governments, but there's always the assumption that in the next election, we'll have a majority. With proportional representation, there would never be a majority party again. So the Liberals would know that over the next 20 years, they have to cooperate with the NDP. Right now, we only have to cooperate with them for a couple of years until the next election. So it's a Liberal welfare state. And luckily, we've written a lot on it. And Liberal is not, you know, we use the word Liberal to refer to like Obama's progressive, he's Liberal. But politically, Obama is to the right of Harper. That's what I used to point out. You may think Harper's a monster, but if you look at his public policies, they're more progressive than Obama's were in terms of healthcare, in terms of social provision, and all that. So we have a Liberal welfare state. We have dominance by the Liberal and the Conservative Party that are closely aligned with the corporate sector. And bottom line is the corporate sector does not want higher wages. They don't want unionization. They don't want greater taxation. They don't want a stronger welfare state. And what's frustrating is this is what ties everything together. That analysis ties together the housing crisis, the food crisis, the environmental crisis. And there's no political party who's willing to go there. There's no political party. I tweeted something out the other day to Andrea Horvath saying, what's causing all these terrible things? What are you going to fix? You're going to fix it. What are you fixing? And they don't want to go there. They don't want to talk about the economic system. And again, you don't have to be a Bolshevik to say if we were a little bit more like Germany and we managed the economy a bit better. But nobody wants to go there. But it makes perfect sense. How do you explain all of this inequality, the premature death, the mortality? You do it because the powers that be that are calling the shots are calling the shots in their interest. And they have such control over the media and the food banks and the disease associations that everybody swallows it. So when you get sick, it's because you didn't exercise. When you get sick, it's because you didn't have enough fruits and vegetables. When actually it's the living and working conditions that these people are creating.
If we can't change poverty, we're not going to end poverty from what you've said. Why couldn't we just focus on child poverty? I mean, the Ontario was under the Liberals were going to eradicate child poverty, and that date came and went, and we still have it.
Is what you do is the anti-poverty groups like Campaign 2000, they thought that if you talked about child poverty, that would have more traction. If you talk about family poverty, oh, they're drinkers, they're drug addicts, they dropped out of high school. So the theory was that if you do child poverty, you'll have more traction. So what has happened, whatever traction it has had, has been limited to children, the child benefit. So you increase the child benefit. You bring them closer to the poverty line. The largest single group of poor people in Canada are not children. The largest single group are unattached adults, 18 to 65. They constitute the largest group. But if you say child poverty, and we're going to help little Johnny, or we're going to help little Mary, and we're going to give their parents $7,000 a year, you divert people's attention from the real sources of poverty, which is lack of unionization, low wages, inequitable tax structure, and corporate domination of public policy. And I said for the last 10 years, we're going to get childcare because childcare does not threaten the Royal Bank's profits. Childcare does not threaten Tim Hortons unless you raise taxes on them. But talk about wages or talk about social assistance benefits. And somebody says, well, how are you going to fund social assistance? You say, these banks made $4 billion last quarter. You tax them more and you take these people's lives out of misery. So, yeah, they're not. Child poverty was a lure. You know, it was the idea that little Johnny's poor and it's not his fault. And that didn't make a difference either. So, of course, the child benefit is helping people, but it's not, they're not flourishing. They're not living the kind of life you'd have if they were a kid in Finland or Germany. It's basically bringing them up to the poverty line, but it's not doing anything to improve wages. It's not doing it in terms of job training. We're among the lowest in the world, in the Western world, in job training. So why don't we do it? Well, we don't do it because fundamental change is not in the interests of the powers that be.
So how do we get people moving on the issues you're talking about?
You know, one of the things I learned the last few years was that Marx was really a fan of Shakespeare. And he and others picked up on the line from Hamlet, the time is out of joint. People know there's a housing crisis. People know they have crappy jobs. People know their kids are stressed out, but they're not told why. And the why is that power and influence and resource distribution is out of whack. So it's a realization that you have to begin to understand what are the forces that are making this happen. And it isn't lack of evidence, it isn't lack of knowledge. It's that the powers that be do not want to address these issues.
Thanks for coming in today, Dennis, to talk about social murder and to really explain everything that it entails.
That was Dennis Raphael and Doreen Nickel in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Dennis and Doreen. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll hand it over to the editor of Rabble.ca, Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. In case you missed it this week, national politics reporter Stephen Wentzel covered the launch of a new toolkit aimed at combating extremism in schools. The 53-page toolkit titled Confronting and Preventing Hate in Canadian Schools looks at how to spot early signs of radicalization towards extremist ideologies, including white nationalism, anti-black racism, anti-indigenous racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, misogyny, and more. The toolkit was created by the Canadian Anti-Hate Network with support from the federal government. The increase of hate-motivated groups and ideologies is a disturbing reality in our country that we have the responsibility to address, said Minister of Housing, Diversity, and Inclusion Ahmed Hassan. In labor news, the Canadian Union of Postal Workers is claiming that Canada Post is placing an undue burden on rural and suburban mail carriers, reports Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga. With the rise of gas prices and the Canadian government's promise to be net zero for carbon emissions by 2050, Canada Post plans on converting their fleet of vehicles from gas to electric. Rural and suburban mail carriers are being left out of this plan, however, and will continue to have to pay high gas prices at the pumps out of their own pockets. Canada classifies vehicles used by rural and suburban mail carriers as contract vehicles, as they are owned by the carriers themselves and not by Canada Post. Rural and suburban mail carriers are currently only compensated for their mileage up to the CRA cap for non-taxable automobile allowances for 2022, which is 61 cents per kilometer up to 5,000 kilometers. Rural and suburban mail carriers collectively drive more than 4 million kilometers daily. The rise in gas prices is forcing some rural and suburban mail carriers to look for work elsewhere. The Canadian Union of Postal Workers is petitioning the government to act on gas price inflation. Also on the site this week, despite its problematic legacy and its founders' abuse allegations, the Playboy magazine empire is entrenched in sex worker culture. Rabble columnist Natasha Jarling examines the history and future of Playboy. Recently, the brand has taken on pop star and former stripper Cardi B as creative director. Since then, revenue has increased by 63%. This begs the question, Jarling writes, what if sex workers were in charge of all sex work and related businesses? Rabble contributor David Kleinman-Haga analyzed conservative leadership candidate Pierre Poilievre's recent campaign video and the many far-right-wing dog whistles it contains. Kleinman-Haga writes, "It's doubtful it's by accident that Poilievre's sinister profundity suggests that if we can only scrape off all the shit and mud and debris, we can restore our dominion to its pristine utopian purity of old. The crude profanity is surely intentional too, a dog whistle within a dog whistle. Who, Kleinman-Haga asks, is Poilievre talking about? Who does he want to scrape off to make the Canadian dominion pure again? Poilievre's dog whistling is nothing new. It's comparable to Jason Kenney's attempts to rewrite Alberta's education curriculum and can be reflected in the recent actions of the activist far-right Supreme Court in the United States." Finally, some news you can use from Rabble's Activist Toolkit. Abortion rights activist Paige Mason shared her tips and strategies for successfully lobbying politicians. Mason writes, quote, "The voice of ordinary people matters in the political process, and knowing how to communicate effectively with legislators can genuinely make a difference. Interacting with politicians requires more than just sending an email. It is a process that takes time and work," end quote. Tips include picking and dedicating yourself to one issue, doing research by collecting data and statistics to support your position, build alliances with like-minded people, starting small with local politicians, then moving your way up, never giving up, and more. If politicians are still unreceptive to your issue, Mason suggests then going to the media and applying outside pressure through protests or by running for office yourself. It is important to remember that change doesn't happen overnight. It requires patience and persistence, Mason adds. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Are you interested in supporting independent news media? Rabble.ca has never had a paywall or charged a subscription fee, and the generous support of our readers and listeners ensures that Rabble's progressive news and views remain corporate-free and accessible to all. Visit rabble.ca/donate to learn more. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nierenberg for supplying the music. And thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.